Hello, my name is Dylan Gose, and welcome to the Existential Delight podcast. So happy to have you here. This is episode 15, and today my guest is Dale Ahlquist. He's the co-founder and president of the American Chesterton Society. He's also a published author and has dedicated much of his time and effort to popularizing the thought of G.K. Chesterton. You can find the Chesterton Society online by searching for chesterton.org. That's chesterton.org. From my interview with Dale, you can expect to learn the following. Number one, what is it about G.K. Chesterton that has impacted Dale so much on a personal level that he would go on to become the president of the Chesterton Society? Number two, what is it about Chesterton's writing style that makes it so compelling? Number three, what is common sense? Number four, what is the odd word South Africans use when we refer to our traffic lights? Number five, why Chesterton is even more relevant in our times today than he was in his own? Number six, what Chesterton thought of Eastern Orthodoxy? Number seven, the Chesterton quotes that Dale uses to get people's attention. Number eight, what one of Chesterton's Father Brown stories can teach us about the nature of evil. Number nine, what Chesterton is trying to tell us about fairy tales and the law of conditional joy. Number 10, what Dale would ask Chesterton if you could ask him any one question. Number 11, how close is Chesterton to becoming a recognized saint in the church? Number 12, if Dale thinks he would have become a Catholic if he had never discovered Chesterton. Number 13, which books Dale recommends if you want to understand Chesterton better. And number 14, where is all the video footage of G.K. Chesterton? If any of these questions interest you, then be sure to listen as we cover all of them and more. But before we set off on our Chestertonian quest with Dale, a quick word about our sponsors. Our first sponsor is me. Support the channel directly by becoming a member. For a small monthly fee, unlock early access to all new videos. You'll see them at least 48 hours before non-members. As a matter of fact, my channel members have already watched this interview. They watched it 3 days before it was available to everybody else. You'll also get a loyalty badge next to your name in comments and live chats, as well as priority replies directly from me for those comments. Plus, you can vote in member-only polls and get access to a growing library of videos that are and will always be available only to members. So become a channel member today by clicking the link in the description or sign up at dylangous.com. That's dylangous.com. And then our other sponsor is hooksounds.com. If you are a creator like myself and you've grown frustrated and tired of having videos you've worked hard on demonetized because you accidentally used a song which violated some copyright restriction, then hooksounds.com is the solution to your problem. For only $14.99 a month, you get a premium subscription which gives you unlimited access to the full and ever-growing Hooksounds library, which is a massive collection of high-quality music, which is constantly growing. New songs are being added all the time. And if $14.99 seems like it's just out of your price range, I have a promo code for you that will give you 10% off. The promo code is Dylan10, that's DYLAN10. If you use that promo code, Dylan10, at checkout, like I said, you'll get an extra 10% off any subscription deal just for being a listener of Existential Delight. So sign up to hooksounds.com today and take your podcast, your channel, or your project from amateur to professional. This is a great investment in your work, so what are you waiting for? The link is in the description, hooksounds.com. And now, ladies and gentlemen, without any further delay, here is my conversation with Dale Ahlquist. Enjoy.
Man, man. You look at the sky.
All the stars, man. The stars are beautiful tonight.
Mr. Dale Ahlquist, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
What a great pleasure to be with you, Dylan. Thank you.
As I told you before we started recording, I started watching your work and found your podcast, the Chesterton Society, years ago when I was first entering Catholicism and I discovered Chesterton. So it is a great pleasure for me to be able to speak with you today. And I have sort of unconsciously built up a list of questions in my mind over the last few years of what I would hope to ask you if I ever got the opportunity to speak with you. And wouldn't you have it, here we are. So to jump into things, just to begin with, what is it about, and I know this is a broad question, so feel free to approach it however you like, but what is it about G.K. Chesterton that would so move you that you would eventually become the co-founder and president of the American Chesterton Society?
Well, there's no question, Dylan, that when I started reading Chesterton, I was encountering a writer unlike any I had ever read in my short life up to that point. But I had been given a good college education here in the U.S., and it was, you know, a highly rated college, and I was expecting that someone of this stature I would have been exposed to in my higher learning, and I felt cheated. It was kind of, that was the immediate sensation. But why didn't they tell me about this guy? And why have I only heard the other side of the argument? Why did I know about George Bernard Shaw and H.G. Wells and Bertrand Russell and Clarence Darrow, all the people that Chesterton debated, and yet his name was missing from the list? So I'd been, you know, even though I was at that time a very devout evangelical Christian, I was still only getting one side of the story. And so it was, I think, a similar response that Dorothy L. Sayers said that she had when she first read Chesterton. She said, it was like a strong wind coming into the building and blowing out all the windows. And I had this very similar sensation. And yet, I have to admit, this was still not even beginning to grasp the depth of his writing and what he was saying. I started with The Everlasting Man, a book I don't recommend anyone begins with, but it worked for me. It worked for C.S. Lewis. So, but I knew that I wanted more of this author and this thinker, and as I continued to read Chesterton, then the feeling came, well, why? Not only why haven't I heard him, but why hasn't everybody else heard of him? I wanted to share the treasure that I'd found. And I think that started almost immediately. I wanted to just grab people on the streets. You got to read this guy. And I guess the passion was there pretty quickly, and it led to many other good things, as I've had the great privilege of being the evangelist for the Apostle of Common Sense.
Yeah, thanks for that answer. I can completely relate with reading him and wanting to, I mean, I don't think it's a grandiose word to use, really to evangelize and to tell people about his writing, insofar as that it would lead them to Christ. But for me, what's always struck me about Chesterton is there's no voice quite like his. I can't really compare him to anyone else. I can see shades, or I can see kind of reflections of his work in Lewis and even in Tolkien. When Tolkien talks about fairy tales, I'm very much seeing Ethics of Elfland come through from Chesterton there. But there's no writer I can say, oh, if you've read this guy, you don't need to read Chesterton. It's always, if you've read this guy, then you have to read Chesterton. You have to go back, right? Have you ever given it some thought about what is it about the way he writes that makes him so unique? Is it the metaphors he uses? Is it a combination of everything? Is there something specific he does that makes him such a compelling writer?
That's a great question. I think it is. We have to talk about the combination of things. I think that's the only way to appreciate. And maybe it is that combination that is specific, to use a paradox. And let's begin there. He's the master of the paradox. So he always has that wonderful twist that he puts on everything. And for some people, that can be very aggravating. And yet, it is absolutely the right approach to truth, because the reason why all these things strike us as paradoxes is because we're thinking the wrong way. And Chesterton's just turning things around. He's getting us to see the world upside down, which is the proper perspective. And so that's one of his great techniques that he is the master of. There are other writers who are paradoxical, and great philosophers who use paradox. And the Bible uses paradox. But Chesterton is truly the master of that technique. And then I have to, the elements of his personality definitely come out in his writing. I think it's been attested by the people who knew him that he wrote exactly the way he talked. It was no difference. He spoke in complete sentences, as it were, but also with all the subordinating clauses. And so you get this uncontrived feeling. There's nothing. It's spontaneous when he's writing. The words are just flowing out of his head, and you really feel like you're in the room just listening to him talk to you. But that's that personal quality. But what comes out of his personality is his humility, his joy, his wonder, and I think sometimes that wonder is at the very ideas that he's recognizing as they come out of his head. You know, he's recognizing the truth right along with us, and yet he's just one step ahead of us, so he's already enjoying it as he's revealing it to us. I think it's a combination of those things that make him unique that you just don't find in really any other writer.
Yeah, very well said. In terms of that unique quality, like you said, it's several things. A paradox seems to be the one recurring theme that really distinguishes his writing as you read it, because paradoxes have a funny way of hitting you, right? Because you instantly know they're true, but you don't know why they're true on the first reading. And so as you give it thought, your mind, like you say, it has to readjust. It has to think upside down. So I think common sense is in a way like that, but perhaps a good way to begin with common sense is just to point out that you actually did write a book, The Apostle of Common Sense, Lessons from Chesterton. How would you describe, or how would you define, common sense?
Yes, and that was also the name of the television series that was on EWTN for years. In fact, the book came out of the series. Common sense is something akin to natural law, I think. It's the truth that everybody knows, but they just haven't articulated it or thought about it. But when they hear it, they recognize it to be true immediately. Oh, yes, I've never thought about it that way, but that's exactly right. And so Chesterton is always slapping us and surprising us with the things that we already know. And I think that's why he's such a great mystery writer. And because the technique of a great mystery writer is to plant a clue right in front of your face so that you don't see it until he reveals it to you. But you've been looking at it the whole time. And I think in some ways that is what God has done with us. He's given us all these truths, and somehow there's this veil in front of our eyes until he lifts it. And we say, oh, that's what I've been looking at all along.
Yes, very well said. I just to add on to that point, I was driving home one day And the road I drive each day, I know in America you guys call them traffic lights. In South Africa, it's quite strange. We call them robots here. So the robot is green or the robot is red. We use the same colors at least, last time I checked. And I was driving home and there's one robot on this road I drive that's notoriously quick. So all the drivers that drive that road every day know it's going to change quickly. And one day we stop and a minute goes by, 2 minutes go by, 3 minutes go by, and all the people behind me start honking their horns. They all start beeping, come on, drive, drive, move. And I realized we'd all come to the same conclusion, which is that there's something wrong with the light. And even though the rules are that when the light is red, you stop, you don't go, our common sense had allowed us to see that there are some situations in which the rule or law doesn't necessarily perfectly lay upon reality. And so it's necessary for us to use our own common agreement in that moment to reassess the situation so that we can move forward. But I'll never forget the person in front of me was kind of shaking her head saying, no, you know, the light is red. I'm not moving. Hence all the beeping. Oh, and I remember thinking, this is a great example of common sense. I'm curious what you think. What do you think of that?
Well, first of all, I have to comment on the fact that your traffic lights are called robots. But one of the great issues now with our artificial intelligence is, are we going to let the robots rule us, or are we going to take control of the robots? And you just gave a perfect example of how the humans rose up against the robots at the traffic stop. And that's refreshing to know. I think with modern technology, common sense will be under attack on a more regular basis than it has been with the rise of bad modern philosophy. And so it's the irony of your semaphores, as another culture calls them, being robots. I'm really curious, how long have they been called robots? Because, as you know, the word came from a play by the Czech writer Karel Čapek, who created the characters of robots in a play in 1920, and then the term came into the language. But ironically, Chesterton wrote about robots based on the play, and our next issue of Gilbert magazine is going to be about artificial intelligence and Chesterton's comments on robots. I think that's so funny that you have to follow. It makes me think, I'm obeying these traffic lights and they're just robots. Okay. Sorry, I'm getting carried away, Dylan, but I have to say one more thing about that, and then we'll come back to your question, and you'll have to repeat it. Do you know that Karel Čapek, the Czech writer who came up with the concept and invented the word for the play, he was inspired for the concept of robots from a Father Brown story by G.K. Chesterton. It's called it's called The Invisible Man. And in that story, there are mechanical servants for the murder victim. And at one point, the mechanical servants are the suspects in the murder.
Wow. Interesting. I didn't know that. I didn't know about that, that's where the word originated. Yeah. You asked how long have they been called that? I'm 27, so my whole life, pretty much. Yeah. So I think it goes back. I mean, you hear people sometimes refer to them as traffic lights, but robot is pretty ubiquitous. Sometimes people will say the traffic robots, but it's one of those kind of South African quirks, I think, that you'll know it if you visit here, because it's so, like I say, it's so ubiquitous. But for us, it's kind of normal. I mean, for us, the robot invasion's already happened. They're on every street corner.
Right. Well, it clearly has happened here. It's just that we didn't recognize it because we didn't say the right word. Yeah, it's happened everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, we don't think of them. I mean, we obviously distinguish between, you know, the kind of idea of a robot, something that MIT would develop as as opposed to something on the street corner. But yes, a machine that guides people's behavior to some degree. And then, you know, an extension of that, probably the furthest extension we have in the modern world right now would be, like you mentioned, artificial intelligence. Mm. I was actually wondering, you know, I often wonder what would Chesterton say, you know, if he saw this news headline or if he saw this or if he saw that. But I find he really has said so much even back then that eerily applies to today. Is Chesterton still relevant today?
Well, I think you recognize that he is, because people often ask me, what would Chesterton say about this? And usually we can find the quote to show that he's already said something about it. That his foresight and his understanding of the way the modern world's direction was going, he anticipated so much of what we are experiencing today, and that's what always makes him so eerily, as you say, relevant. Sometimes it's astonishing, the lines of his prophecy. It's just unintended, you know, it was so natural the way it just flowed out of him. You know, back to 1902, he says, "We are learning to do a great many clever things. The next thing we're going to have to learn is not to do them." How many times has that been true?
Yeah, and I was recently listening to the audiobook of Heretics, and the heresies are still very much here. We just have different figures kind of espousing the same heresies. And obviously Chesterton addresses some of the heresies kind of tongue in cheek, but specifically, I think it's when he's talking about Shaw and Shaw's kind of obsession with the Nietzschean Übermensch, and how it's actually the ordinary man that is the strongest, paradoxically. And that's why the church maintains through time, because a chain is as strong as its weakest link. And that weakest link is so, you know, he says it so beautifully, that the weakest link is really the strongest, because the ordinary man is the most extraordinary thing, and his ordinary wife and his ordinary children. So the reason I bring that up is just that critique. I can still go to a friend's home, and we could be having a friendly discussion around the dinner table, and they could talk about the need for us to create new values today in 2023. And Chesterton's critique is just as valid, if not more valid now, based on what we've seen in the 20th century, right? So you can, I think in some ways, it's not just that he was right back then, he's almost more correct now, because we have more evidence just through time of the things that he claimed that would come about have actually happened. And yes, go for it.
Well, I was going to totally agree with that. I think he, in many ways, is more relevant to our times than to his own times. I think he was definitely appreciated in his time, but I think he befuddled a lot of people because they didn't realize how prescient he was about what was happening. The irony of the prophet without honor in his own country, it's certainly the fact that Chesterton is not as appreciated in England, in his native country, as he should be. But because people are discovering him now, there's also been a pushback against Chesterton now because of his prophetic accuracy, and people are rejecting that someone speaking with such traditional ideas is so right on the money. And there's a strange pushback. There's people like ourselves, the Catholic converts, and people who follow the trajectory of history, and say Chesterton was calling it all along, and other people who are just pushing back against the idea that, you know, orthodoxy is still right, and it doesn't go away. We don't need to change anything. We don't need new ideas. The old ideas are can still sustain us and satisfy us.
Yeah, and in a, you know, the conclusion of that would be that they are really the only things that can in the bigger picture, right? Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting now to see, especially I'm a millennial, so I'm, like I mentioned, I'm 27, and just looking around at the kind of landscape right now, you have a lot of young guys who are converting or they're looking for more traditional forms of religion, just because I think as the world dissolves more, people are naturally going to crave structure, just like as if you were in the dissolving waters of the ocean, you'd naturally crave the structure of a lifeboat just to keep you afloat, right? And then as you get comfortable on the lifeboat, you start finding more things to help you enjoy the journey back to land, to safety, just to continue with the metaphor. I wonder, something I've wondered about, and I have not read enough Chesterton to really know, but I would love to ask you, there seems to be a kind of crossroads a lot of people get to where they realize they want some form of orthodoxy, and then they, on one end, there's Catholicism and its many rites, and then you have Eastern Orthodoxy, which is, of course, you know, just distinct from Orthodoxy as Chesterton uses the phrase in his book. Did Chesterton ever write about or consider Eastern Orthodoxy, or was he sort of always focused on Catholicism?
Yeah, he does write about Eastern Orthodoxy, and he writes about it with great respect. He talks about the fact that it was really the last, even though it was Eastern, was really the Eastern outpost of Western civilization, defending Western civilization against the far Eastern ideas, which ultimately Chesterton says there's the Western ideas and the Eastern, there's Christianity and all the variations around it, specifically Catholicism and its gradations of Protestantism and everything. But on the East, there's Hinduism and Buddhism, and everything else is a variation of that. And they have two distinct goals and two distinct paths. You know, the goal of Christianity is communion with God, communion, the fulfillment of all our desire. The goal of Eastern religion, you know, epitomized in its ultimate form by Buddhism, is the cessation of all desire, nirvana, instead of the fulfillment of desire. And those are two absolutely opposite extremes. Well, Eastern Orthodoxy is on the edge of the West, defending that. It's Chesterton says that it's influenced somewhat by the East, but versus the icons are a more Eastern phenomenon than the three-dimensional sculpture of the West. But as far as the religion and the rites go, Chesterton speaks very highly of it. He also talks about the natural attraction to it. But he does point out that Eastern Orthodoxy does not represent any kind of a universal church or a unity to it. It is this very national. It's connected to usually to a particular culture. There's not one Eastern Orthodox authority as there is in the papacy. And he says it just doesn't represent the universality of the church the way the Catholic Church does. And I think those of us who have examined that in our own conversion experience, a lot of Protestants like myself do look at Eastern Orthodoxy and flirt with it, because if they can avoid becoming Catholic, they will. and they're drawn to the ancient church, and they see that Eastern Orthodoxy is the way to go. But ironically, the Eastern churches really are kind of what should we say indifferent to converts. They're not seeking converts. They're not seeking to have outsiders join their church, because they really are very tied to their ethnic origin, and they're happy with that. But they don't evangelize the same way that the Western churches do.
Thank you for that. It struck me now as you were saying that I think you get multiple levels of Chesterton fans, if I could use that word. And I think there's the average guy who just discovers him, who just gets into his work, which you and I have both been at some point. Then you get somebody who perhaps knows his work better than the average person, but is not, has not read most of his work. I've read all the main titles, and I've read some of them quite deeply. And then you get that level. And then I think you get the kind of, where you are right now, president of the Chesterton Society. I'm curious, is there a kind of deep cut, unknown fact that even pretty hardcore fans of Chesterton aren't aware of that would maybe surprise some people that you're aware of? I'm really just curious.
What a great question. Yeah. Well, I think the question you asked about Eastern Orthodoxy is something that most deep hardcore Chesterns don't know what his attitude was towards that. But he writes about it in just a very few places. So, I mean, okay. you already nailed one of them right there. let's see. Yeah, I'll have to think about that some more. So I'm gonna come back to that one if something hits me, but nothing immediately came to mind other than the point you just brought up.
No problem. That's actually why I thought of it, because I realized actually I wonder how many Chesterton fans actually do know about his views on Eastern Orthodoxy. So if you do think of something, you can let me know, but otherwise, no worries. That actually brings me to another question, which would be, is there a specific thing Chesterton wrote, or a specific idea, or a specific metaphor that he used that filled you with so much wonder that when somebody brings up Chesterton and they don't know him, and you kind of want to really just make a good impression on the spot, right? Is there something that specific, some idea, some that really filled you with wonder that resonated with you very deeply?
Well, we talked earlier about paradox, and so I often quote a couple of good paradoxes to get people's attention when I'm talking about Chesterton, especially in a small, a more intimate conversation. For instance, when he says that the self is more distant than any star, that immediately makes people start thinking that the biggest mystery in the world continues to be ourselves. We make all these fantastic scientific discoveries, and our growth in knowledge is completely amazing, but yet we remain a mystery to ourselves. And Chesterton is willing to make us go deep into ourselves to unlock that mystery. He is, I think, the other great insight about, we are in a world where evil is on the loose. And one of the Father Brown stories, Chesterton talks about how you can't maintain one level of evil. Father Brown talks about this. That path always goes down and down and down into the last abyss, he says. And that's what we seem to be watching in the world today. Every time there's some new level of evil that we're being asked to accept, and this is all we want. We know it's wrong, but just grant us, the rest of us know it's wrong, but we should be compassionate and grant that. Well, it never ends there. It always gets a little worse. And once again, Chesterton called that, it can't maintain one level of evil. And we're seeing a total disintegration of the moral fiber that holds our civilization together.
Evil cannot be maintained at a specific level. It makes me think of sin within the individual. You might go to confession and come out and, you know, you allow sin into your life in some small way, but you can never keep, you can never, you know, if you think of yourself almost like a encampment with several layers of gate around you, if you allow it through just one gate, it will inevitably get through to the center. It's just a matter of time, right? I think on a broader scale, that's sort of the micro level. On the macro level, it's the same thing, right? Inevitably, evil will get to its, you use the word abyss. I'm quite fascinated by people's reactions to Chesterton, because I think, like you said right at the beginning, when you read him for the first time, you think, how are other people not talking about this guy more? I mean, this is, and then you might think, maybe I'm just reading too much into it, right? Maybe maybe it's not that amazing, and I've been living in, you know, Plato's cave for the last 10 years and I haven't really realized it. But then I get to people, and so I have like a few stocks that I rely on. One I actually heard you say once, which is where in a poem Chesterton's talking about the lady in blue, and it's not said directly, but it's sort of implied that he's speaking about the Blessed Mother. And he describes the various colors and why God chose those colors for those parts of her, if I remember correctly. One of the things he says is that he made the skies blue, and the color we associate with her is blue because if it was good enough for eternity, then it was good enough for her, right? Another one that I find very moving is in Orthodoxy, his comparison between the imagination and the sun and reason and the moon, and how the moon is so crisp, and that it's that's why the moon has given her name to all madmen, all lunatics, right? Just kind of sweeps you off of your feet. I'm curious on that note to maybe focus in on an idea that has really moved me in a way that I can't really point to anything else that has done the same for me. And that's in chapter 4 of Orthodoxy, most people's favorite chapter, the Ethics of Alfland. I actually think that what he's saying there is so radical that I think most of us, myself included, the first time we read it, we don't really grasp what he's trying to say. And I want to just say something to you, and then I'd love to hear your thoughts. But I think the initial reading of Ethics of Alfland would leave you with the impression that, oh, fairy tales impart moral lessons to people and moral lessons to children, and that's beneficial. You know, it's not just that there's a dragon, but the dragon can be beaten, which is in many ways what Jordan Peterson is echoing now for the modern audience. Chesterton already said that, you know, back then. But I think on a deeper level, Chesterton's actually trying to reveal to you that fairy tales are trying to change the way you perceive things. There are sort of two forms of logic. There's the logic of 1 + 1 = 2, sort of deductive logic. And then there's the logic of eggs coming from birds and how that isn't really a logical connection in the same way that 1 + 1 = 2, or that an unmarried man that a bachelor can be a married man, right? That's a different form of logic. That idea has kind of been on my mind for, well, since I read it. I want to ask the question to you this way. In your mind, what is the core idea Chesterton is trying to convey to the reader in chapter 4, in the Ethics of Alfland? What is he trying to have you understand?
An easy question today, huh? Okay. So, well, it is a chapter that you can return to again and again with, which is true of so much of Chesterton. You just go back. It's a deep well. You can keep satisfying your thirst in it, and there's always more to draw from. The Ethics of Alfland is not... is trying to remind us that what we learned in the fairy tales, that those truths have not gone away. And it came to us in the form of fairy tales because as children, we could immediately grasp their truths. And that's why it's just the most important lessons I learned were the ones I learned in the nursery, because those things have always been true. With the, you know, like Cinderella, the humble will be exalted, and Jack the giant killer, you have to be afraid of the thing in order to be brave. You can't have courage unless you have fear. And Beauty and the Beast, you have to love a thing first in order to make it lovable. You know, those are eternal lessons. But people reject the fairy tales because they claim they're illogical. They're not real. They don't describe the real world. And Chesterton's point is that there are things within Elfland, within the fairy tale world, that are as true as in this world and that cannot be changed. One of the things that cannot be changed is logic itself. 2 + 2 is always going to be 4 in Elfland, just like it will be in our world. You can't think of 2 and 2 not equaling 4. That's the impossible thing for us to consider. So those rules are rigid in both worlds. But with the factor of the imagination, he's pointing out that the things that we think are scientific laws are not really as rigid as we believe them to be. And our imagination can certainly recognize the possibility of a miracle, the possibility of an impossibility, as it were. And that's where he talks about what is a scientific law. And I think that's one of the most scientists who read that chapter are awestruck, because he says that's exactly the fallacy that we operate on, what a scientific law. We try to explain the law of gravity to anyone. It's really so, well, these objects will be drawn to other objects. But what is gravity? You cannot explain what gravity is. What we can explain are weird repetitions that we will bet on those repetitions. But they aren't necessary, and sometimes those laws can be broken. For instance, you know, when a saint starts levitating. You know, a saint has broken the law of gravity with levitation. And you know, anything that's a miracle goes against the natural scientific laws that we have observed. In other words, the weird repetitions that we claim are laws. And he says, you know, that the definition of a law is that it's something that can be broken. You know, that is just a marvelous, marvelous insight, that there's a will behind even the universe. So we're recognizing that God's laws are there because he has willed them, but he is allowed to break them. He can make a miracle happen even in the natural world that he's created. And man's laws, of course, we break those ourselves, and then we suffer the consequences, but there's always an act of will. So the law is not what must happen, it's what should happen. And in the ethics of Elfland, in the fairy tale world, the laws are what should happen. And if you do break them, you will suffer the consequences. If Cinderella doesn't get home by midnight, her coach will turn into a pumpkin. And if that couple, you know, doesn't follow that one rule they're given in this garden, they will be unhappy. It'll ruin everything if they break that one law about eating that fruit over there, the law of conditional joy.
So beautifully said. So the fairy tale, you actually have the power in a way to cause deviations in the natural order of things. Like Cinderella could actually, she could violate the law in a way that we can't, right? So I can't just, you know, it's not like if I don't get to bed by midnight, gravity will suddenly cease. But in the fairy tale's case, that law can be violated to try and show the reader that actually there is a purposive element behind natural law, behind the things we observe. And in a way, miracles are only impossible if naturalism is true. But if there is a God behind the laws and these laws are willed, then they can be willed differently. Is that fair?
Absolutely. I think that's fair. Chesterton says all this points to, there's a story and there's obviously a storyteller. That's, you know, our life is a story. Our world is a work of art. There's got to be a storyteller behind it and an artist behind it. And that's one of the other great ideas that comes out of that chapter.
I don't know if it's a personal question, but it really, I think, is a question that maybe you've been asked before. I'm sure you've wondered about it. But if you could have dinner with Chesterton and you could only ask him one question, what would it be?
You know, I when I think of my relationship with Chesterton through the years, you know, I already feel like I have had dinner with him many times because I think I would just do the listing. I would be smart enough to listen. And that's been the basis of our friendship until now. But the idea of asking him anything I wanted, you know, I think, I have been asked this question before, Dylan, and as you can tell, I haven't come up with an answer yet. I've just been, everyone says, oh, wouldn't you have liked to have met Chesterton? I said, I have met Chesterton. In fact, I'm with Chesterton every day, and I feel like he's my companion all the time. And I think that's why we're making the move for, you know, for his canonization, because that's what saints are. They're your friends. They're your companions. And I feel like I'm with them all the time right now.
So when you say you're making the move for his canonization, I've been following this for a few years now. Is that process, you know, is it measurable? Is there a way to say, you know, we're this many steps closer to achieving it? And if so, where are we in that process?
Yes. It's the next step is a bishop officially declaring the cause open. That happens when a petitioner officially petitions the bishop to open the cause. No petitioner has officially petitioned the bishop, because you don't petition the bishop until you know he's going to say yes. So he gives the signal, now's the time to make the petition. And so obviously we're going to be the petitioner. And we've worked with several bishops who are very interested in open the cause. But a few years ago, I was in close dialogue with the Bishop of Northampton, England, who's the most, you know, that's the logical one to open the cause. That's where Chesterton lived. That's where he was received in the church. That's where he's buried. And he declined to open the cause, but he said, I don't want to stand in the way of the cause being open. So I'm just not the one to do it. He was ready to retire. He had no familiarity with Chesterton himself. Okay. So he just felt uncomfortable being the one to do it, but was totally encouraging at the same time, even though he knew that his news would be discouraging to me. But we had a very good relationship. And the new bishop is much more open and possibly cooperating with another bishop somewhere else in the world. And so I think that very soon there will be an announcement that the cause has been opened. And once the cause is open, the candidate is declared a servant of God. And before the cause is open, the bishop has to inform the congregation for saints in Rome of the intention, and the congregation has to issue a nihil obstat, that there's no objection to the cause being open. And we have people at the Congregation for Saints who are anxious to see the cause open as well. So there's a lot of enthusiasm for it, but nothing moves quickly in the Catholic Church. And, you know, it took 500 years for Joan of Arc and Thomas More to be canonized. So some are quicker than others. There's the Santa Subitos, you know, like Mother Teresa and John Paul II. But I think I still have great hope that I can see at least things move along in my own lifetime.
Yeah, that's good to hear, because sometimes you see articles online or descriptions online. You don't know how old they are. You don't really know where the process is. So to hear it from you, that's good to know that there is still an active plan to make it happen. St. Chesterton one day would be... it sounds interesting. But it also sounds right, though.
We have these prayer cards. And the prayer for his canonization, for his beatification being open, is on the back of the prayer card. But we have distributed probably 30,000 of these in the last 10 years. So yeah, there's a growing cult to G.K. Chesterton. There's no question.
Do you think you would have become a Catholic if you had never discovered Chesterton?
Well, I can tell you, I can't imagine. I was as a Baptist. You're both subtle and overtly anti-Catholic. You don't have any belief that the Catholics are right. You think they're wrong about everything that they. That's why you're a Protestant. You're protesting against the Catholic Church. That's your starting point. And it was Chesterton that opened the door. And he and then led me to the door. That was the thing. He describes the three stages of conversion in his book, The Catholic Church of Conversion. He says the first step is you decide you're going to be fair to the Catholic Church. And most Protestants are not fair. Most outsiders to the Catholic Church are not fair to it. But as soon as they decide, okay, I'm not going to necessarily accept what the Catholic Church is saying, but neither I'm going to accept all the criticisms. I'm going to weigh them now. I'm going to be fair. But Chesterton says there is no being fair to the Catholic Church. You're either for it or against it. And as soon as you stop being against it, you suddenly feel yourself being drawn towards it. You suddenly start rooting for it. And that's exactly what happened in my case. And, you know, praise be to God, it was because I met a group of Chestertonians who were Catholic, and they were the first Catholics that I'd ever met who were articulate and comfortable in talking about the Catholic faith, which is something I hadn't encountered in other Catholics before. So, well, you know, I'm Catholic, and that's it. They didn't do a good job of explaining why they were Catholic or what it meant to them, you know, which doesn't speak well to our own preparation in training our own believers within the faith, because the Catholics can really turn people off if they don't do the right combination of knowing what it is they believe and a compassion towards unbelievers. Yeah. But then the second stage is, he says, discovering the Catholic Church, just learning all the things that you never knew before. And that's the fun part, because it's like being in a foreign country with exotic animals and butterflies that you've never seen. And you're taking it all in, and it's fun because there's no commitment. You can turn around and leave anytime you want. You don't live there. But then the third stage is running away from the Catholic Church. And that's when your head has been convinced. All the intellectual arguments have been satisfied. It's still an act of the will and an act of the heart. And your will is trying to talk you out of it. and get out of here now, because your life is going to change completely. And it ends, as Chesterton says, with your head bowed, and an act of humility. You enter the church with your head bowed, and you discover the great truth that the church is larger on the inside than it is on the outside. Another great paradox. But I can't, I know of other people's conversions. I love the stories of conversions, but I can't imagine how I would have found the Catholic Church without G.K. Chesterton. It's my own story, I guess.
Yeah, I've been asked a similar question in a different way in the past. And I like to say that I think and I hope that God in his grace would have led me to the church through some other means. But it just so happens that that was the means that perhaps I needed with my specific combination of background and interests. So I think that if that's the manner in which it needed to happen, then, so be it. Then, Dale, just to maybe end this off, I know a common question to ask people who are into Chesterton is, which Chesterton book should I begin with? But I think we all, if you're somewhat interested in him, I could list them immediately, right? So Orthodoxy would be my recommendation personally. Although I would say probably read his essay on cheese first, because I think that will just expose you to some very interesting thinking. But here's a question I'd like to ask you, and that's, what is a book about Chesterton that somebody who wants to learn about him before necessarily reading the original text, what is a good one you could recommend?
Well, I do recommend that people start with one of my books because they were designed to introduce people to Chesterton. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it helps to read one of those books even before picking up the real thing, because I think my books help prepare the reader for what they're going to encounter when they read the pure product, as it were. So both The Apostle of Common Sense, which is my first book on Chesterton, my second one's called Common Sense 101 Lessons from G.K. Chesterton. And the first book kind of goes over his main works. It gives an overview of the ones, some of the books we've discussed here. And then the second book takes Chesterton by theme. And there's really, it's very supplemental. The two books don't really overlap much at all. So he's both the different themes that Chesterton writes about. And I draw from much broader sources of Chesterton's writings. Because he was so amazingly prolific, we're constantly drawing from a myriad of sources. But he was primarily a journalist. He wrote more for the newspapers than he did books. And there's a lot of great material that we have been gleaning to help get Chesterton's great insights out there and spread once again. But those are the two books I recommend.
Wonderful. And then one last question, just out of my personal curiosity, before I ask you to tell us about what you're currently working on, I have wanted to ask you this question for a while, and that is, where is the video footage of Chesterton? Because I've seen the one where he's in America and he receives an award, and that's really the only one I'm able to find. Is there some person holding on to a catalog of video footage that they're just not letting go of? Do you guys have access to that? Or I'm really just curious.
I think you find on the internet, but there are a few silent clips of newsreels, again, when he came to America. But we have been searching the internet very hard and other archives very hard. There is a BBC documentary from the 1930s, probably between 1932, 1934, in that range, just shortly before his death, where he was doing fortnightly broadcasts, book reviews. And there's a little clip in one of those, in that BBC documentary. It shows him sitting in front of the microphone and reading a passage from one of his reviews. And then there's also a great a scene of a young boy escorting him through the studio. And Chesterton actually wrote an essay about how he was being filmed for this, and how it was just quite a bother for him. And yet he was very amused. And he knew that this was very important to the little boy who was leading him through the studio. And to know that we actually have his reaction to, and then we get to see him on film. So that's a BBC documentary. I think it's through BBC One. And it was very difficult to get a hold of, but that can be found. And then we found just some little tiny clips, you know, for Silent. You just see him walk by. That's about it. So we have three main recordings of his voice. And two of those were BBC broadcasts, and one was an after-dinner speech. And then there's the one that you saw at Holy Cross College, where he's made an honorary crusader. And he gives a nice little acceptance speech. But yeah, he's been escaping us in the video film world. It's amazing. Obviously, he'd been filmed more, but the stuff just hasn't survived or hasn't been found.
Yeah. It's amazing that you can have someone's voice in your head for so many lines and sentences and paragraphs and books, and yet you have never really seen them in any, you know, at least not in color, nor really heard their voice, right? Really had the time to hear the intonations of how they speak and all the rest. Although we do have a pretty good idea, I would say, of at least insofar as we do have some recordings. But Mr. Alquist Dale, thank you very much for your time. I really enjoyed speaking with you. It was a real treat. And I want to give you the opportunity now, if anyone is watching this, and they're curious about the work you do and they want to explore, where should they go? Where would you point them to?
Well, our website is chesterton.org. It's pretty straightforward, chesterton.org, O-R-G. Don't go to chesterton.com, Dylan, because then you'll get hydraulic valves made in Massachusetts. But at chesterton.org, we have a great introduction to Chesterton on there, and people, if they would like to join the Chesterton Society and support our work, we publish Gilbert Magazine, which is full of many good things, lots of original Chesterton, along with just good quotations and contemporary articles using Chestertonian principles, whether it's about education, theology, or economics. Chesterton's relevant, and it's a wonderful publication. Working on some new books, but some of the books that I've written are also available from our website.
Dale Alquist, everyone. Thank you so much, Dale, for your time, and wishing you a blessed day. And please keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you, Dylan. God bless you.